Bring in show music, please.
This is Squawk Pod, the daily podcast brought to you by the team behind Squawk Box.
NYC, this is CNBC Control 2.
CNBC's essential morning show.
PCR 2.
Every day, get the best stories, debate, and analysis from the biggest names in business and politics.
All right, what can we do next?
Today on Squawk Pod, FedEx versus the New York Times. The shipping company's fiery CEO is making headlines for making headlines.
He was also one of the sort of most vocal proponents for the tax cut and specifically said, if, in fact, we got the tax cut, everybody, corporate America across the country, was going to spend a lot of money on capital spending.
Ford President Joe Hinrichs has a vision for the road to auto electrification, and it's paved with way more than just Teslas.
Can we redesign the transportation network, inclusive of all the technology available out there?
He's starting with the company's newest electric unveiling, the Mustang Mach-E. And famed author Walter Isaacson takes a philosophical stand on free speech on social media.
In the marketplace of ideas, you end up getting closer to the truth with free speech.
Okay.
The problem with Twitter and Facebook is that you don't have a marketplace. You have micro-targeting.
Those stories and much more, from violence in Hong Kong to Silicon Valley's plays for more power. I'm CNBC producer Cameron Costa. It's Monday, November 18th. Squawk Pod begins right now.
Stand by, you by. Three, two, one, cue, please.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Squawk Box here on CNBC. We're live from the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. I'm Becky Quick, along with Joe Kernan and Andrew Ross Sorkin.
First up on today's podcast, an escalation in Hong Kong.
Some violence in Hong Kong escalating over the weekend as activists armed with makeshift weapons threw Molotov cocktails and fired arrows at police. Meantime, a court ruling that the government ban on wearing masks at protests is unconstitutional. And NBC's Matt Bradley joining us right now live from Hong Kong. His evening, our morning. I'll say good evening to you, Matt.
Good evening to you. Now, this siege has lasted well into the evening. Last we checked, there were hundreds of protesters still holed up inside this university, which is just actually right beyond these buildings here. As you can see, there's a police line here. They're not letting us get any closer. It's our understanding that some of these protesters have gradually been being let out. They're being treated for injuries and illnesses. Some of them have complained of, you know, injuries from the violence, but also from hypothermia from the water cannons that were employed yesterday against the protesters. All of this really came to a head very early this morning when the police launched a pre-dawn raid trying to retake this university. We saw some really dramatic images from these hundreds of protesters who used this university as kind of a citadel or a fortress. They actually mixed their own cement on the grounds and built up walls around the university. They made homemade catapults, as you mentioned, bows and arrows. And one arrow went through one of the police officers' legs. And then just today, police have said that they consider this and other acts like throwing Molotov cocktails at the police to be murderous acts. And that's why it's unclear whether these protesters who are being let out of the university, what they're going to be charged with, if at all. A lot of these protesters in recent months have been charged with rioting, which is a very serious crime here in Hong Kong, and it carries a sentence of up to 10 years in jail. So imagine that against some of these people who are really just teenagers. So this is going to continue on. We're seeing that these hundreds of people are not able to leave the campus. It's unclear whether the university officials are going to succeed in their negotiations with the police to create some kind of deal, some kind of amnesty, to finally bring this, one of the most violent chapters of a now nearly six-month-long crisis here in Hong Kong, to a close. Guys?
Okay. Matt, thank you for that report. We should say the chaos is taking a toll on business. A new Chinese media report says that hotel vacancy rates hit a record high and average room rates now plunged more than 46% by the end of last month. So if you want to make your way to Hong Kong, there are discounts to be had.
Stocks pushing to new highs, the Dow topping 28,000 in Friday's session. We have an update now on one big market catalyst, the China trade talks. Over the weekend, Chinese Vice Premier Liu said he spoke on the phone with Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin and U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer. Chinese state media says the men discussed a phase one trade deal, and the discussions were constructive. Eunice Yoon joins us now with a read on how Chinese officials are viewing the impeachment hearings and what that could mean for a deal. Larry Kudlow has been saying we're getting close. I've heard that a couple of times in recent days. Eunice, you're hearing that maybe we always go three steps forward, two steps back. What is your insight here?
Well, actually, I spoke to a government source who is familiar with the trade talks, and there appears to be growing pessimism within the Chinese government that a trade deal can be done, and especially by this year. And the source had told me that there were a couple of events recently that have really soured the mood within the government. They said that President Trump, about a week ago, appeared to say that a phasing out of tariffs would not happen. And that's something that's really important to the Chinese and was one of the reasons why the Commerce Ministry had announced it, that the Chinese felt that they had a deal, at least in principle, on a phasing out of the tariffs. And then a few days later, they were put off again. They said, the source said, when President Trump had said at the Economic Club in New York some harsh words about the Chinese. In addition to that, there is still disagreement over some of the basic points within a phase one deal. One of them is the agricultural purchases. As you guys know, the U.S. Wants China to commit to specific targets. But this source said that from the Chinese perspective, the concern, or at least one of them, is that this can be off-putting to some of their other trading partners. So all of that is adding to a very negative picture over here. And then he did say that the Chinese now are looking very carefully at the political situation in the United States, especially about the possibility of impeachment. He said there's a lot of discussion now within the government about the election that's coming up only a year away. And all of that just raises questions as to whether or not President Trump is even going to be in office in the next couple of months, guys.
All right, Eunice, thanks.
FedEx has had an eventful year. The shipping company filed a lawsuit against the U.S. Department of Commerce. It's being investigated by China regarding a series of shipping accidents involving Huawei products. And in August, it broke up very publicly with Amazon. Since this time last year, the FedEx stock has fallen nearly 30%. Far underperforming UPS, its main rival. This is all under the leadership of Frederick Smith, the company's founder, chairman, and CEO. And now, another day in the headlines for the fiery founder. Here's Becky.
FedEx CEO Fred Smith is firing back at the New York Times over an article about the company's tax bill. The New York Times published an expose yesterday on the company's taxes. The paper reporting that between 2017 and 2018, FedEx managed to cut its tax bill from $1.5 billion to zero as its effective tax rate dropped from 34% to less than zero. Financial filings show that FedEx actually paid $2 billion in federal income taxes over the previous decade. The Times said that this all came after FedEx and its CEO, Fred Smith, in particular, lobbied hard for the Trump administration's tax cuts. Those tax cuts were designed to encourage capital investments by companies. But the Times said that FedEx spent less on that in 2018 than it did in 2017, passing most of the savings on to shareholders through buybacks and dividends. In a statement last night, Smith calls the report distorted and factually incorrect and challenges the publisher and business editor of the Times to a public debate. The Times has yet to respond to Smith's challenge. It was a very lengthy piece. Read through the entire thing. It was put on the front page. And it kind of looked at what's happened with corporations overall, but it used Fred Smith and FedEx as their vehicle for how they told this story.
To me, and I don't know the history of the piece, but the interesting part was less to me about FedEx, actually, and about the larger question or larger issue that I think that the piece was effectively illustrating, which was that what the authors of the article did was apparently look back at every company that had lobbied, not just lobbied, but every company that had gotten a big tax break as a result of the tax cut and what they ultimately did with the money. And to me, what was so interesting was the companies that had the biggest tax break, oddly enough, spent less money on new capital investments.
Although, you know what? They hedged that. I read through it very carefully. They never said what the company spent in 2017 or in 2018 on capital expenditures, just said less than, more than. And on what they spent in 2017, they said spent less than they had projected in December of 2016, right before it passed. But they never said what it was versus 2015 or the rest. And that's, they were just some numbers that were missing from it.
Was the point of, it was not in the op-ed pages.
No, I think.
Okay. Well, was the point of view, in your view, a fair description of the state of things? Because the last one, which was in the op-ed section, the Gabriel Zucman piece, that was totally...
I think the point was...
we should expect that, right?
No.
It's like you can discount it. Like, I see it, and it's like, okay, you know.
I think the larger point...
Well, what's Fred's problem with it, then?
The larger point of the piece was the companies that got huge tax cuts didn't go and use it on capital spending. What was the point of the tax cut exercise?
Yeah, if the demand warrants additional capital spending.
Correct, but that was...
And it's the company's decision. It's their decision, only their decision, not the people that decide they should be doing it.
But the reason why Fred Smith, I believe, was called out in particular in that piece was both because the number got to zero. And look, I think because you can depreciate assets as quickly as you can.
I think that's what happened.
That's what they did.
But you can spend it in the first year. And I think they did spend a lot on CapEx.
Having said that, he was also one of the sort of most vocal proponents for the tax cut and specifically said, if, in fact, we got the tax cut, everybody, corporate America across the country, was going to spend a lot of money on capital spending.
Well, we'll see.
And ultimately, I think... I think it worked for a couple of quarters, and that's what the article was. And we'll see.
There was a global slowdown, obviously. There was a manufacturing slowdown.
The piece also brought up the Trump trade war might be part of it.
And we see that there was a specter of a recession that now has faded a little bit. So all these things factor into what a company does. You can't get blood from a turnip. If it's time to spend on capital, you do it. Just because you say you're going to, have things change in the rest of the world and things slow down.
Sure, but that's a counter argument for why the tax cuts maybe didn't do what they were supposed to do.
If it goes into buybacks, if it goes, at least it's not staying abroad where it was. At least some of it's being repatriated.
But no CEO in America was running around Washington saying, "Please give me a tax cut so that I can go buy back my shares." I'd actually love to see a debate with Fred Smith. I would too.
It'd be interesting to kind of watch it play out because it's very much.
I mean, you didn't even have a problem. You wanted to cut to, like, I don't know, you parse. You want to go to 28 instead of 22 or whatever it was. Okay, we needed to be more competitive. We had higher rates.
I would have gone with lower tax cuts on corporates.
Right,
100%.
Okay, but not this low. And you would have paid for it. I've heard it all before. But I'm just saying, the point. I just know I would have been annoyed with the point of view at the time. And I'm sure, without even going into it, you read the piece. Exactly. I won't read that paper.
Okay, I told you that, Andy, I won't read that paper.
And I will default to Fred Smith's position on it. Against the New York Times, 99% of the time.
I have deep respect for Fred Smith, but I'm not going to take a position on this particular issue.
I thought it was interesting, but I also just thought...
I will tell you that you're missing out.
With the New York Times, maybe the style section, as you can tell.
I will go back to the point, though, that there were numbers missing, and I read the entire piece looking for the numbers missing.
God.
They weren't in there. I would have liked to.
Well, I was too busy winning four out of five games.
On DraftKings?
Yes. Yeah. Back almost to $600.
Okay, well, I want to talk about...
Four out of five, dude.
The FAA is weighing how to approve planes for flight in the wake of two crashes involving the Boeing 737 MAX jet. In an interview with the Wall Street Journal at the International Air Show in Dubai, FAA Administrator Stephen Dixon said that the agency is considering ways to fundamentally alter how new planes are certified. Now, he said that that could include the FAA being involved in the design of the planes from the very beginning. And this would fundamentally upend and change the way this sort of self-certification, self-regulation has taken place over the last 20 years. There's been a real move within the United States. By the way, this is also true of what's taken place with regulators in Europe in terms of how a lot of these systems have been certified by the airlines themselves. If you get the FAA involved at the very beginning, it may very well be very helpful, but I can't imagine. I mean, it'd be very interesting to see whether Boeing or Airbus, if this were to take place in Europe, were to push back on this. And in terms of the leverage point at this particular moment, I actually think it's very difficult for Boeing, to turn around and say, actually, you know what? We don't want that.
Would the FAA then have engineers and others on board who would be working for them instead of working for the companies?
And I don't know how they would do that.
Right.
And I don't know where the money would come from. It would require more spending.
It would require more spending,
and we have to figure out as a country what we want in terms of how much money we should be devoting towards this.
The head of the FAA had some pretty harsh words on Friday that made it sound like it may take longer than Boeing has suggested for the 737 MAX to get back up in the air. He just made it sound like we're going to go at this at our pace. Some of the software, the FAA is not even ready to start doing some of the software testing that is required for this at this point. So the market has may have gotten ahead of itself in terms of thinking that this is where the timeline is going to be.
Just in reading it in the way in, just the front page, because on the way in, you can see on Twitter, they have the whole front page of the journal.
Oh, sure.
So you get that out of the way on the way in. And reading it, it was like, it just sounded like almost, of course they're saying this, of course they're saying that, of course. Yeah, we're going to, now we think we should spend more time with the pilots when there's a new system training. You knew that was coming.
Right.
Just a lot of the things that were there, you knew were coming.
Right.
You knew after what was happening. Just almost sounded like, yeah, it's just exactly what I expected.
Why did they not
exactly.
do it to begin with?
It's exactly what I expected the FAA to
say. Yeah.
Cheese will be next.
Up next on Squawk Pod. The president of Ford explains how the automaker's new electric SUV is just part of a larger industry shift.
We're used to having gas stations on the corners. We can find them. Now you have 12,000 plus charging locations across the U.S. that we're tapped into.
Back after this. You're listening to Squawk Pod with Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Here's Joe.
Ford unveiling its electric SUV at the Los Angeles Auto Show, the Mustang Mach-E, marks the beginning of a new generation of all-electric vehicles, and it's the first time.
Huh? It's pretty.
Yeah.
It's a pretty car.
It's a cool SUV. It's the first time the Mustang name has been used for an SUV, and I think that's a commentary on how serious the company is. Joining us, because you don't use a brand name like that lightly.
No,
Joe Hinrichs is Ford Automotive's president, and Joe, great to have you. Great to have you in studio. I think part of the seriousness of this is what Bill Ford said. We've pushed all our chips to the middle of the table because it's 2%. It's a small part of the market, but you're going in big by using the Mustang name.
It is today, but as the next 5 to 10 years evolve, you're going to see a lot more electrification taking place in the industry. Well, this vehicle starts under $44,000.
No, not the vehicle, but just to make this move, not knowing how many you're going to sell. It's still going to be a niche
Over the next several years, it's going to be smaller volumes, to be sure, but we believe in the next 5 years, you're going to see significant improvement and increased volume in battery electric vehicles. And then by the end of the decade, actually, I think you're going to see a pretty substantial increase in the portfolio.
There are analysts that are actually making comments about competitors like Tesla, saying that they no longer are the only game in town. And they actually were, this analyst happened to be very negative on Tesla, saying that the shares could be way too high based on players like Ford getting into the marketplace. Does it compare to a Tesla, the way it feels, the acceleration and everything else?
Well, yeah, it does. I mean, battery electric vehicles have a similar feel because of the torque and the instant kind of power you get.
Right.
And the great acceleration you get because you're right
at
the wheel.
That's similar.
That's similar. Actually, the GT version of this Mustang Mach-E will go 0-60 in 3.5 seconds.
So,
I mean, it's a sports car. I mean, it's fabulous. I'm going to get a GT version myself. And I own a lot of sports cars because I know the enthusiasts will love it. But, you know, We wanted to wait until it started to make economic sense to get into electrification in a big way, and you're starting to see that. We've announced an F-150 battery electric truck coming. Now you have a Mustang Mach-E. More to come after that.
When you say because it now makes economic sense, is that because the cost of batteries and everything else has come down? Is that because you think the market for these vehicles has grown in size? Somewhere,
it's
combination
really,
of the two.
It's all the above. I mean, the charging network, we're now part of the largest charging network in the United States because that's a big deal to people.
Mm-hmm.
The cost of the batteries have come down.
Because that didn't exist before.
Right. We're used to having gas stations on the corners. We can find them. Now you have 12,000 plus charging locations across the U.S. that we're tapped into.
So there's a little bit of chicken egg here.
Consumers are getting more and more accepting of it.
Right.
The costs have come down, to be sure. And, you know, now that we have a lot more capability of the batteries, we can control them better and give a lot better performance to the customer.
What would Blockbuster be for a couple of years from now for this, for sales? What would be unbelievable for Ford, would you say?
Well, if you think about the next 5 years, it's pretty predictable. I mean, given the technology.
Not going to be that high.
No, I mean, the sales rates have been remarkably high.
You'll make money on this?
We're contribution margin positive right from the get-go with this vehicle. We're going to
make it's made in Mexico, which is also kind of a flashpoint.
Well, part of the reason why it's made in Mexico is a global vehicle. It's important to our European portfolio, and we can export from Mexico to Europe duty-free. Okay. That's a big part of this. But, you know, we make 80%+ of our sales in the U.S. are made here in the U.S., so we're pretty proud of that. And our manufacturing plants in the U.S.
You expect to hear do you expect any mean tweets?
Well, you know, the White House knows this is part of our plan. Remember, far as Ford goes, we produce more vehicles in the U.S. than anyone else. We employ more manufacturing workers than anybody else.
A lot of times those things don't matter.
We export more than anybody else. Well, the facts hopefully matter in this case.
Well,
typically, we are the most American auto company, and we're proud of that.
How many sort of design cues and things do you think you have taken, dare I ask, from Tesla? The reason I ask is you look at that big, almost iPad screen that's very Tesla. The grill in the middle without a grill, almost grill-less. I don't even know what would you describe that as. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Well, because you don't need the air intake anymore.
Because you don't need the air intake. Yeah, and right. Maybe that's just a function of
a bad electric vehicle, really. But the design cues of this Mustang Mach-E are really from the Mustang. If you look at the tri-bar, you know, lights and the taillights in the back, you look at the front end, it's a Mustang, you know, in its soul. But, of course, battery electric vehicles do offer you more freedom in the design because of the nature of where the batteries are low and the center of gravity is low.
Now that you've put the Mustang name on an SUV, will you still be able to make Mustangs out of regular cars?
No question. This is not supplementing or replacing, it's not replacing the Sport Coupes, which, you know, number one selling sports
car. Can you take it further, though? Does the Mustang brand now translate into other categories as well?
Well, the Mustang brand stands for fast, affordable, and fun. So we don't want to go far from there. From an SUV, a bad electric SUV, this is very affordable.
Right.
But so the fast and fun part's really important. So I don't think you're going to see a van of Mustang anytime soon.
What about wants a minivan? She wants a minivan.
Well, we can give her other options in the SUV portfolio.
Number one, you got to talk to her, not just say, okay, honey. You got to try and talk some sense into her. But
happy wife.
New Explorer.
New
Explorer Hybrid is what she really could be great for.
Will there be a sports coupe EV Mustang?
Not in the near future, but probably someday. Not planned for anytime soon. We have the GT500, 760 horsepower coming out this month, actually. But the sports coupe continues on. We did talk about making a hybrid version of the Mustang. But when we do that, we use the electricity to give more propulsion, more acceleration, to make the feel of the Mustang better, not to replace the kind of horsepower you need to make it a sports car.
Separate question for you on autonomous vehicles. For the past couple of years, we all talked about this sort of race towards autonomy. Everybody was talking about self-driving. It was all going to happen so fast. And you'd hear Elon Musk and others talk about it as if it was a 2020 reality.
Yeah.
And it feels like, at least in the last 12 months, the whole thing has slowed down to a crawl. What's happened? Where are we?
Well, reality has set in to a lot of people. We were more pragmatic right from the beginning, saying late 21 kind of time frame. This is a big challenge. It's a big technical challenge. We're on our path. It's going to happen someday. But we got to be, you know, safety first for everybody, of course.
But when you just said 21, are we now 25? I mean, what is the realistic view of this?
I think you're talking 5 years to be a realistic, see it in volume. But you will see it in the next year or two, start to roll out in pilot geofenced areas.
One person gets mowed down in a sidewalk, and how long do you recover for that? One person. And there can be zero. You need a Six Sigma. Remember GE?
No, I know,
you need one mistake and 8 million.
It feels like the whole enthusiasm and sort of just
It's because it come down to reality, I think.
The expectations for how this performs compared to human driver are very high. So it is a high threshold, to your point. So we're all taking it very carefully.
Zero
I was driving an autonomous vehicle in Miami on Saturday morning.
Yeah.
And in Miami, it's that's a really tough environment. A lot of things going on.
Yeah.
The vehicles are performing very well, but it's going to take years to get this right. And then we have to make Congress has to actually pass laws to make this legal. And there's all kinds of legal considerations to think through. But it's coming. It's just going to take some time to get it right.
All right. Thanks.
Thanks.
Don't bring the Pinto back.
That was fun.
Mustang Mach-E.
Next on Squawk Pod. Apple's removing apps and Google's buying Fitbit. But are things about to get harder for tech giants? Wall Street Journal tech reporter Dan Gallagher expects a tough road ahead.
These big tech companies are going to have a hard time doing almost any size of deal.
And author and CNBC contributor Walter Isaacson raises philosophical questions about tech company missions.
What is the business Google is in? They're not in the fitness business. They're in the data collection business.
We'll be right back.
Stand by Pro A. Pull wide six. Play Pro A. Dissolve. Change music.
Welcome back to Squawk Pod. The final story or series of stories on today's podcast, tech. Andrew kicks off a conversation with famed author and CNBC contributor Walter Isaacson. He's this guy.
I love
that. We ought to. It's an interesting thing.
It is interesting.
The author of many biographies, including ones of Steve Jobs, Benjamin Franklin, and Leonardo da Vinci. He also penned a book chronicling the digital revolution and the giants that made it possible. Also a part of this conversation, Wall Street Journal reporter Dan Gallagher.
I think it's a reason why these big tech companies are going to have a hard time doing almost any size.
He's covered tech for two decades. It's a pretty distinguished crowd, if we do say so ourselves. Here's Andrew.
All right, Andrew has these stories next.
Our next story, Apple removing 181 vaping apps from its app store. This happened on Friday, citing the rise of health problems linked to vaping. Obviously, President Trump also on e-cigarettes over the weekend now seemed to take a step back.
Can't figure out where he's going on.
He was very much against cigarettes.
And then he had a meeting.
And I think was told basically that part of his base, he could lose some of his base if he goes after e-cigarettes. And he was very strong on the issue. I mean, emotionally, sort of where he wanted to be. And now I think a little political wind is.
It's usually a lot of times those bells don't go off in Trump's head, but that went off.
Well, I think it was his wife and daughter who pushed him.
Maybe
one of those things too.
Originally on the issue.
Yeah.
So I guess the bigger question is: you're seeing Apple do this. You see, I don't know if Google. You think will ultimately. Do similar things, take these kind of apps off their service?
I'm not sure. Google and Apple have been less polar opposite in the way they've approached their app store. Apple's always been, I'll use the word paternalistic, from the beginning. They've made clear that they're not going to let any kind of app at all on the app store. So I don't think this move is a big surprise for them. Google's been a lot more of the Android app store has been more of a Wild West type of thing where they just kind of have hands off. So I don't really know if Google will go down that road. It's not surprising to me that Apple did it at all.
No, it's very much in the DNA of Apple ever since the very beginning that this is a curated store, that you don't want the whole Apple and iOS devices and systems polluted by people being able to plan anything.
But it's interesting to me that Apple's taking effectively, I don't know if you call it a political position, but a position on the...
They do it on hate speech. They do it on nudity. They do it on a lot of things.
But this goes back to all the things we were talking about, Twitter and Facebook now with...
Bingo. I was about to say it goes back to all these things where platforms either do... Or they don't take responsibility for what's on
for Google, it's like anything goes Wild Wild West. Unless you're in China. And then, whatever you guys want in China, we won't put that on, right?
Well, in China, Google doesn't even do business.
That's what I mean, though.
But Apple does business in China, and by the way, does, I think, basically what the Chinese government wants.
Right.
So
it's not what our...
meanwhile, talking about Google, we should tell you some Fitbit users telling CNBC they started looking for alternatives for tracking their fitness when they learned of Google's acquisition of Fitbit because... they don't trust Google. What do you make of that?
Well, when I wrote my column on that deal, I actually had people sending the same thing to me. I mean, it's anecdotal. I don't really know how many people are doing it, but it speaks to, I think, the core problem that Google's going to have with this acquisition is this sort of lack of trust and this image.
Do you think it's a business issue, or do you think that the government's... I mean, I think the government's going to look at this transaction in a way that maybe they haven't looked at transactions of this scale before, because usually you'd say, oh, they're small in this space, they have nothing to do with it. Mm-hmm. And then if... 5-10 years from now, all of a sudden they own the space, people will go, what were you doing?
I think it's a reason why these big tech companies are going to have a hard time doing almost any size of deal because everything right now is going to get looked at. So even if it's hard to argue that Google's going to become a much more powerful company by owning Fitbit right now. But
it's all
now everybody's worried about what they're going to be in 10 years. 20 years.
And a different aspect of
it.
But
it also goes to what is the business Google is in. They're not in the fitness business. They're in the data collection business. And this is something where antitrust enforcement, I think, has been shifting, is going to shift left and right, whether it's Josh Hawley or senators on the left. They're going to say, we got to go back to an antitrust regime that says it's not just about consumer pricing in very narrow markets. It's about Google leveraging its monopoly in certain fields to get into others to be part of the data collection machine.
Do you think moves like this, Google buying Fitbit and Facebook getting into Libra, is that tone deaf, realizing what's happening in the markets? Or are they just figuring, we better run while we can because they're going to shut us down?
Well, obviously getting into Libra was a bit tone deaf because suddenly the music started playing and they had to... back off. I think that, I think you're not going to, I agree, we're not going to see a whole lot more acquisitions. I mean, the notion that Facebook could get, you know, Instagram or these.
Wouldn't happen today.
Yeah, and it was because antitrust enforcement for the past 10, 15 years mainly looked at harm to consumer pricing, which is not much if it's Facebook or Google because they're free. But the real pricing comes from them having your data.
Well, look, I don't know if you saw Facebook announced maybe just a month ago they're buying something called Control Labs. I don't know if we talked about it in the air. This is a device that goes on your wrist that actually reads your, effectively reads your brain, right? And it's half a billion dollar acquisition.
Very, very comforting to
talking
have Facebook.
About, talking about data collection.
Why would you worry? Right.
And by the way, we talked about it on this show, but otherwise I've heard basically nothing about it. And so the question is, do regulators look at that in a different way?
And I think it's mainly
so unique and so different from where their current business is. This is the fundamental question.
But that's why you have to define the business as, is it a business of making you fit or is it a business of getting your data?
But it is a shift in regulatory scrutiny and thinking for it. And that's a big lift to get to that point.
It's a pretty big lift, but it's, as Joe and I always do, we go back to the past. I mean, this is the way they took on Standard Oil. This is the way they took on US v. Microsoft. It was not on consumer pricing. It was you're expanding into other endeavors using your dominance in a particular field.
We try to go back to the past.
You
we can't go back to the past.
You wind up a computer there.
Yeah, exactly. We had a lot of time. I don't think we have enough time now to talk about, you used to be the biggest promoter of the ACLU and free speech, and now you're just a big censor. Now you like Jack Dorsey. You think Jack Dorsey's a hero and Mark Zuckerberg.
We're talking about Twitter.
And how they really aren't going to ban political.
Because I teach this in my Tulane class, which is what would you do for Twitter and Facebook on political ads? And the reason you like free speech is that in the marketplace of ideas, you end up getting closer to the truth with free speech.
Okay.
The problem with Twitter and Facebook is that you don't have a marketplace. You have micro-targeting so that a particular ad, true or false, especially a false ad, goes only to a tiny segment of people, say people who hate you know, gays in African-American communities in a precinct in Detroit. That means you don't. So I would make a rule for Facebook, if I were offering it to Zuckerberg, and I think some people have talked about it, say you can do political ads. You can even have all sorts of political ads you think may be dicey, but you can't micro-target them. They have to go to everybody. Everybody's got to see them. And that gives you what Oliver Wendell Holmes said about free speech, was you put it in the marketplace of ideas.
But you don't think that Dorsey's move was purely for competitive reasons and the shame Zuckerberg.
I don't think
they didn't have a big, it didn't matter much on Twitter anyway. So they were able.
It didn't matter much on Twitter. I do think it is important to take responsibility.
And now they're backing off. Now they're backing down on that even. And what the journal called a sanctimonious.
I'm not sure there are any businesses that don't have business reasons for what they do. I would hope there aren't. But I would also think that if you're going to take responsibility for what's on your platform. If you're Twitter, you should say, you can buy political ads. You just can't micro-target them. We're going to make them random. So we have a democracy in which everybody gets to discuss things.
Most people self-micro-target. I do. I only watch certain cable channels.
Yeah, but your ads are not. Your ads are micro-targeted based on your preferences. But they can change that algorithm and say the ads will go to everybody randomly. Right.
All I see is Joe Namath trying to sell me Medicare things. That's the only ad diet. So again and again and again and again and again. That's all I see is Joe. He looks good.
Looks good.
Those were the days.
Okay.
That's the show for today. Thanks for listening. Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Tune in weekday mornings on CNBC at 6 a.m. Eastern. To get the smartest takes and analysis from our TV show right into your ears, subscribe to Squawk Pod wherever you get your podcasts. We'll meet you back here tomorrow.
We are clear. Thanks, guys.